You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Paranormal Portal Podcast. I'm your host, Brent Thomas. I'm absolutely thrilled you're here with me. Thanks for checking out the Paranormal Portal Podcast. And if you're new to it, welcome. And if you're familiar with it already, thanks for coming back. And make sure you're subscribed so you get all the updates on the new podcast, because the Paranormal Portal Podcast drops three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So there's always a new episode coming down the pipe if you're watching for them. So I'm really excited about our show today, ladies and gentlemen, because I got a special guest joining me today. And I think it's a great subject because, of course, our popular media is full of references to this, but we're here to set the record straight. But my guest today is Mr. Mike Hetzel, who is a paranormal investigator, and he's joining us today on the podcast to talk about all things investigating. So welcome to the show, brother.
Hey, thanks for having me, buddy.
Well, you're welcome. It's wonderful, and I appreciate you making the time. I know that you're plenty busy and all, but, you know, as I was saying before, there's so many examples, especially nowadays. It's hard to turn on the TV without catching some ghost show somewhere doing investigating and such. And it must be kind of cool for you, being an investigator, to continue to see how popular this has become.
I think it's a good thing that more people are being exposed to the idea, or maybe they've had an experience, didn't want to talk about it because maybe it was taboo in the family, and now they're seeing a lot more shows about it and it's being more openly discussed. Mm-hmm. I think all that is good. Right. I think that there also is some bad that goes with that, where a lot of this is being treated like some type of paranormal thrill ride. And I'm not very keen on that. I don't think that's a good idea. But I think that there is some good where it gets exposure and people talk about it. I think that the more people talk about this, the faster we'll figure this out.
Sure. Yeah, right. The more people that are sharing thoughts and ideas and their reflections on the phenomena, you're right. I think the more voices there are, the more we have a chance of understanding. Good point.
What we need is, first and foremost, as investigators and researchers, I think we need to come together as a group and try and figure out what it is that we actually believe. Because it's kind of scattered and it can vary wildly from one group to the next. And I think that the best way to go about that is long-form discussion or panel discussion. So we got to get together, we got to talk about this, and we got to hash it out.
You know, I think you're right, but don't you think in terms of spirits and spirituality, a lot of the diverse ideas or beliefs have a lot to do with religion and people's understanding of religion, no matter what that means. And I'm not advocating or promoting one over the other, but we tend to take our spiritual cues in many cases from whatever religion we follow. And that certainly seems to influence people's perceptions in quite a big degree. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the religious dogma can have an impact on how you view this subject. Mm-hmm. And I think that that can play a part in it. But I think that we've got to, as a community, come together and start talking to one another.
Right.
And try and figure this out.
Yes. And one example of that that really has struck me, and it's something that I've run into many times being a researcher into the paranormal, is that there are plenty of religious groups, and let's just take, for example, some flavors of Christianity, that they don't believe there are ghosts. They know there's something around, and it's not that they don't believe in the paranormal or the supernatural, but by virtue of them not believing that they could possibly be human ghosts, then, of course, they believe they are something much more nefarious and evil. And I don't think that that's a fair assessment just based upon a religious observation. You know, I do think that there are human spirits, but there seems to be predisposed ideas of what these things are based around that religious framework, as it were.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that the word demon gets tossed around way too casually, much more than it deserves to be.
Right.
And I've talked about this before. There are spirits that are going to do things. And I firmly believe that human spirits retain their personality after they pass. Mm-hmm. Think about the meanest person you know. Now imagine them as an invisible entity that can move at the speed of thought. And what would that look like?
That might be kind of ugly, I'm thinking. What do you think?
Yeah. might be rather malevolent. So I don't believe that every malevolent spiritual encounter is going to be something like a demon. I think that I say this to people. Evil exists and it's out there. But you're not very likely to encounter it.
Good point. I think you're right. And I think that in many people's eyes, I think it's kind of both ways, though. I think it's people claiming they're encountering demons. And there's also researchers, I think, that love to throw that word around because it has, for lack of a better term, street cred to it. Well, I was dealing with a demon, you know, and it sounds like they've been through such amazing. It's like fishing stories for paranormal investigators, right?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. It's a good way to pad your resume to say, you know, you want to say that you were just dealing with regular people or that you were dealing with demons the whole time.
Right.
And it's a good way to pad your resume.
Yeah. And so I stumble on that a lot too, when researching different groups and stuff and how they love to throw the demon around because that's a great thing. It looks really impressive and it really seems to make them seem so incredibly capable and, you know, establish them with a lot of instant credibility just by virtue of throwing that word around. But I think you're right. I don't think that there are nearly as many demons around as there are claims of demons around.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that it's just an overused term. Hollywood is to blame for that. TV is to blame for that. You know, there's a culture behind it. But yeah, I think that we're both on the right track here.
Yeah. Now on the other side, there are other things too that were never human as well, but they're not necessarily demons. But what do you think of the other kind of entities that might be out there? Have you run into any of those? And by those, I mean like shadow people and perhaps nature spirits or elementals or things to that nature. Do you have any experience with anything like that?
You know, I don't know about, I think people have called them elementals or nature spirits. I'm not quite sure because I'm not very well versed in that. Mm-hmm. Shadow people, and I have talked about this before, or at least I've written something about it. shadow people, I believe, are, it's, I don't believe that they're their own thing based on the fact that the reports of them vary wildly. They can be either benign or extremely malevolent. They can take different forms. They could have glowing eyes, or the Top Hat Man is a pretty famous viewing of a malevolent spirit. I think that shadow people are a way for spirits to manifest themselves in our three-dimensional reality, in the same way that it's well documented that we know that spirits can manifest themselves by absorbing heat energy out of the atmosphere, making a cold spot. I think that they do the same thing with light energy, making a dark spot.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's actually very brilliant. I think I remember you saying
that
before.
Well, let's not get carried away here. It's just a working theory. But yeah, I think that seems like a better answer than they're just their own thing. I think there's too many examples of stories of dealing with these things that vary all over the spectrum. I don't think it's any one thing. I think it's just a vehicle for spirits to manifest themselves.
Okay. No, I think that's really a great observation, and that does stand a reason for me. Now, I've heard many psychics say that, you know, just because you see a shadowy spirit doesn't mean you're seeing a shadow man or a shadow person, that sometimes spirits choose to manifest that way. And one, I can't remember the lady's name, she's a very famous psychic, but she said for whatever reason, they will, if they're going to appear, they'll appear shadowy so as not to draw a lot of attention to themselves. Now, the part that I don't understand with that, and perhaps I'm really misquoting her, and I'm not naming her, so I don't feel real bad about that, because, you know, it's that's my memory for you, so I don't have to apologize to that individual. I could be really badly interpreting what she was saying, but it seems to me that spirits don't have to be seen at all if they choose not to be, but they can choose to manifest. So if they choose to manifest but don't want to be seen, then why would they choose to manifest at all? So it's kind of a conundrum, I guess, but... what do you think of that idea that sometimes they choose to be shadowy or other formations?
I think it would make sense to manifest as a shadow, because in a given room, especially at night, there's going to be a lot of shadows around. So it would be easy to camouflage yourself and hide in a corner and just watch what's going on.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. Good point. Now, there are some kind of, for lack of a better term again, parasitic entities. And I think that a lot of times when people are referring to the shadow people, they are referring to these kind of entities. But it's also could be like succubus, incubus, or other things like that that seems to draw or sustain themselves on the life force of the living. Do you have any opinion on things like that?
I'm not entirely sure yet. I haven't really, that's another area I really haven't researched.
Yeah.
It's not where I kind of pointed my research right yet. So I'm not sure. Is it possible that these things want to live or kind of have a symbiotic relationship with us? It's entirely possible that they just hang around us because it's some type of sustaining vehicle for them. It could be.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that in the case, and Don found this, and he actually heard it on an old episode of Art Bell, and I don't remember whether it was on Coast to Coast or later, but he was talking to a shamanic person, or at least a medicine man kind of person, who had lots of training with the First Nations, and he was talking about the shadow people, and he had a specific name for them. But he made them sound so much more utilitarian. In other words, and I kind of like this description, and I don't mean to belabor the whole shadow man, shadow people topic, but it is curious to me. What he had explained was that they do feed on negative energy, but that is good. In other words, they come and draw off the negative energy that people are holding. And it sustains them, and it also is more purifying to the people that they do it to. And I thought that that was really neat, in that maybe there was more of a altruistic nature to that and more of a utilitarian nature to that kind of relationship, and that they could draw off the negative energy and, you know, sustain themselves and also be a benevolent force to the people that they're drawing it from.
That's an interesting idea.
Right.
I haven't heard of that before. That's where it's kind of a distillation, where they're siphoning off the negative energy off of people. That's really interesting. I've never heard of that.
Right. Yeah. I'll have to ask Don for more information on that, or to try to figure out where you heard it from, and I'll let you know, but it's very interesting. Now, we had made a reference of the fact that there are so many shows in our popular culture and on our televisions and on our cable networks and so on of paranormal investigators, and whether it be ghost hunters or ghost adventures or kindred spirits or whatever flavor it happens to be. On the whole, would you say that those shows do a pretty good job representing what it is to be a paranormal investigator?
I would say mostly, although it does seem to glorify it a bit, and there's a lot of work involved in doing this. So especially if you're going to do an investigation, there's equipment that you have to carry and set all of it up. But the problem that we would have for new people is they would watch the shows and think, oh, well, that's easy. I could walk around with a camcorder. That's a piece of cake. And then, no, all this equipment in the back of the truck, you're going to lift that up and we're going to carry it to places. And we got, you know, hundreds of feet of cable we got to lay. We got work to do. It's going to take a while. What do you mean we got work to do? And then, you know, now they're not all that interested in doing this.
Right. So what do you mean there's work involved? That's not what I saw on TV.
Yeah, that's the kind of the thing that we would run into. Mm-hmm. Or what do you mean I'm going to sit in this room over here? Yeah, you're going to sit here and you're going to see if anything happens. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not what I saw on TV. Yeah, I know. They don't show that because it's kind of boring. But yeah, this is what we do here.
Yeah, and I think that's a great observation, and that those shows are incredibly edited. And not that in a way that makes them dishonest, but in a way that excludes a whole lot of the normal day-to-day stuff that these people do in their investigations. Like you're saying, the setup, there's, you know, sitting around for hours and hours waiting for something to happen, or looking for something to happen, or looking for, you know, ways to trigger something to happen. And a lot of times, I think, you know, in the traditional sense, I think if a paranormal investigator left an 8-hour investigation with an EVP or two, that would be a success, you know? And I think that
it would be noteworthy. Yeah.
Right.
And I think that, because of the magic of TV, you can have a 6-hour and 8-hour investigation that gets condensed down to 22 minutes. It seems like a lot happened,
right?
But really, over the span of 6 or 8 hours, it wasn't very much.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think that these shows may have left people with the idea that you buy a camcorder, you get a EMF detector and a pocket cassette recorder or pocket recorder, a digital recorder. You go out and you get all this amazing evidence, then you put it online and you're instantly recognized as an investigator, and it's simply not quite that easy. It's maybe given people an unrealistic expectation of what it means to do some real investigating.
Yeah, I think that's right. Also, we had the extra dynamic of I started on this team in 2010. It was called IPART, Iowa Paranormal Advanced Research Team, and we were a TAPS sister team.
Oh, okay.
And what that means is we're part of the TAPS network, so for the state of Iowa. So if somebody had a problem in the state of Iowa and they sent an email to TAPS, that got disseminated to some managers that sent that to our team, and then we would contact these people.
Okay.
Which was really pretty interesting most of the time, but a lot of the time is they would contact us, we would get a hold of them or show up to do a walkthrough, and the first question out of their mouths is, well, when is Jan Grant showing up? No, you don't understand. We're going to show up. And then if something really interesting happens, then you get the big guys. But for right now, it's just us.
Wow. Well, that's funny. I'd never heard about that before. But that, so in other words, you would be a preliminary investigation, and should you have found anything, then you'd refer it back to the main TAPS people, and then they would schedule in one of the Jan Grant shows and the rest of the team.
Yeah, if it was interesting enough or something really important happened, or yeah, then all that information got disseminated back to them.
Now, let me ask you a question. Did you ever find a location like that you referred back to them?
No.
Okay.
Not while I was on the team. Apparently, there was a case in Iowa that did get on the show, but that was before I was part of the team.
Oh, okay. Okay. Very interesting. Yeah, and I always really, of all of the shows that I've been on, and I was really excited to hear that they're actually coming back with a new show, the TAPS team, minus Grant. I don't think Grant is a part of it, but it's going to be Steve and the Jason Hawes and Dave yeah. Tango is going to be the main center of the show, but they're going to be doing it again. Apparently, it's coming out this fall.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, I might take a look at it. Yeah. There was every year they would do kind of a gathering, and a couple of years back they did one kind of in the center part of America. Uh-huh. And there was a number of people on our team went to that. Now, I couldn't because of work, but they said that Jay was a really down-to-earth guy and really just, you know, a normal everyday person.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I mean, they always came across really – really great. And I always loved the approach on those shows, because it was always just like, hey, I'm Jay, this is my friend Grant, and we're just here looking for, you know, to see what's going on. And it was just really respectful to me. And I think that, you know, when these ghost shows first came out, with the exception of TAPS or Ghost Hunters, a lot of them, like even Ghost Adventures, when they came out, they were all about provoking. They were all about trigger objects. They mm-hmm. were all about, you know, the shock factor in order to inspire some kind of events. And I always thought that just seemed so incredibly aggressive. And you know, the reason being is that I think that in most cases, if a spirit is left behind, if they haven't transitioned, if they were a human spirit to begin with, they haven't transitioned, they're already in a state of confusion and pain. And then to have this crew of people come in and act like they're circus performers and they should jump through the hoops on command and stuff, I always felt that it was so disrespectful.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Most of the people we dealt with were people in private homes, right? So we had clients in private homes. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you don't want to do if you're dealing with somebody in a private home is kick the hornet's nest. Right. Because now you're guaranteeing that client a really bad time. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that. You want to be respectful to whatever happens to be there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because at the end of the day, you go home, but that's where they yeah. live. So
that's right. You get to go home, but the client has to deal with whatever it is you stirred up. And, you know, so it's going to sound kind of silly when the client calls you like, hey, what did you guys do? Because things are going crazy. Yeah, but we got some really good evidence of it. I don't think they're going to care that much.
No.
They're going to be kind of mad at you. Right. So be careful.
Mm, very cool. Now, talk about I guess, you know, we got just a couple minutes here. But when we come back from the break, we're going to break down some of the equipment and techniques and stuff that you rely on a lot in your investigating. But, you know, I guess we can, before the break, probably address, there seems to be an ever evolving base of tools or equipment that people are bringing into these investigations. What do you think of that? Or do you think that a lot of it is just a lot of hype and wishful thinking? Or do you think there's some great new things that have been coming out?
I haven't really kept up on a lot of the new gadgets. Mm-hmm. I'm not a real big proponent of gadgets. I'm a real proponent of old school investigative techniques. So you're there with a pen and paper and a camera and a flashlight and a couple of other things. And really, that's all you need. Like the tools are just extras to help you pick up something or
sure.
maybe something's there that you can capture. But I think that, you know, that we have to get to the core of investigative technique.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And I think that'll be great to discuss on the other side of our break. So I guess maybe this is a good spot for us to do that. So ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break and don't go away. We'll be back with our guest and discussing so many more things, such as the equipment and techniques. And I've got a lot more questions for Mike to deal with. So we'll be right back, everybody. Don't go away. Gentlemen, we're back and we are at it. This is the Paranormal Portal Podcast, as you well know, and I'm still Brent Thomas, so you are still in the right place. But I am joined today by Mr. Mike Hetzel, who is a paranormal investigator and is joining us today to discuss all things paranormal investigating. And once again, Mike, thanks for being here and being a part of the show.
Absolutely. No problem, buddy.
Well, you know, you've been a guest on our live show as well. And you were on the panel discussion when we had a couple other investigators join you and we discussed it. And what a great show that was. The one thing that I was really happy with was the fact that all three of you and all three of you have been guests on the show, but all three of you had such amazing insights. And there was still even though you guys had never worked together, there was still a real synchronicity between the way you all approach things. And I thought that was really cool. And I imagine you do run into a lot of different styles, depending on the group that is investigating. Have you been a part of a lot of different groups, or what is your background as far as being on teams?
No, I was just on that one team, okay. IPART, from 2010 to 2016, to where, you know, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, so I don't really get an opportunity to investigate a lot. So now most of my time is focused on research.
Right. Yeah. And ladies and gentlemen, the cool thing is Mike does research as he's going over the road, and some of the things he's found has been absolutely spectacular. Now, if you wouldn't mind, could you share a couple of the neat experiences you've had as you've been traveling around in terms of paranormal events?
The one that I shared was I had an encounter here in the truck, which is interesting because that means that not only are spirits on static areas like land or houses, but they can also move around with you where you can pick up transient ones while you're in motion. Mm-hmm. And so one night I was in the truck and I've got a TV set on the other side of the bunk and I started seeing things move in the TV like shadows. And then I started seeing shadows moving about the cab and I was thinking, okay, all right, got somebody around. So I set up just my cell phone on a simple voice recorder, mm-hmm. about 5 or 6 minutes. And that's when I picked up the EVP that says what twice. So first it's really quick, like what? And then the second part is what, mm-hmm. which is pretty interesting. So something was poking around and checking us out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also shared with me this one experience where you saw a figure walking by the gas pumps.
Oh yes, yeah. I was in Des Moines. I was stopping for fuel, and I'm at, we call it a fuel island because it's rows of fuel pumps, so it's like an island, so fuel island. Mm-hmm. So in the fuel island, and I see somebody walking. They've got a black jacket on with a hood up. I can't see their face. They're walking towards the fuel island. They get to the pump section, and then they're gone, just entirely disappeared. And it was a three-dimensional person. Just wow. I could hear them walking, come up to the fuel pumps, and they're gone. And I'm like, yeah, that's okay. All right.
That must have been a little intimidating, maybe a little bit, huh?
Not necessarily intimidating, but it was definitely interesting. It was something to note.
Right, and of course you've heard of the black eyed kids, those stories, right?
Oh yeah, I listened to the episode and the podcast. Those are really creepy.
They are. Now, the funny thing is...
It's black-eyed children that show up at your door. Hey, could you let us in? We're waiting for our parents. No, get out of here.
Get away.
Good Lord.
Now, there are
people... Get away.
There are people that have observed them, like not necessarily the people they're visiting, but there's been cases where people are observing them visit someone. Like, for instance, in this one story... These people were living in an apartment complex, and across the way, there was three stories of the same complex, but it was like in a big horseshoe type of shape of a building or whatever. So the people on one side were looking out their patio door, and they lived on the main floor, the ground floor. And suddenly they saw these two kids out on the balcony, on a second floor balcony. You know, there's no way to climb up to the second floor. And they're knocking on this person's patio door, and this person said that they watched them, and and she kept thinking, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, those are the black eyed kids. I'm sure of it. And she said she saw the light come on in the unit across the way. The woman that lived over there was clearly talking to them, but didn't let them in. And the person that was observing this was like, oh my God, thank God, didn't let him in. And then ended up slamming the blind shut and just, you know, freaking out. But the person watching them said, as she stood there watching them to see what they would do, suddenly they both turned around and looked right at her. So they were well aware she was watching. And she said she just quickly looked away. And I might be badly paraphrasing this story, but as I recall, she looked away. And then when she looked back, they were standing on the roof of the building. So it was literally that quick. They were up on top of the building looking at her again. And I don't remember exactly how it ended. Nothing more came of it, as I recall. But I think they ended up getting a visit as well after that. But, oh, my God, talk about creepy. So they.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Good Lord.
They seem to be a spiritual thing almost. But... the people experiencing it obviously think there are, you know, they're really there. I mean, in three-dimensional reality, they are there. So when you told me the story of the gas pump thing, that's what I'm thinking. It's like, could this have been a black-eyed child or a black-eyed kid? Because they oftentimes are wearing those hoodies and get the hoods up, and you can't really see their face, and they're always looking down, and they've been known to disappear like that. So really creepy.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it didn't approach me, but that was definitely interesting.
Yeah, well, good thing, brother. So now let's get a little bit into the kind of equipment that you normally use on your investigation, because of course, you know, for people that are interested in getting into the field of either ghost hunting or paranormal investigating, and those are two very different fields. But what would you recommend? Because it would be really easy to blow a small fortune in a hurry, thinking that you have to get all the bells and whistles because you see them on TV. What is it that you think is paramount to bring on investigations?
Flashlight, pen and paper, some type of digital audio, digital voice recorder. Mm-hmm. What I use is a laptop recorder with a parabolic microphone that's running Audacity or some other sound processing software, but that's kind of an extra. Really, just a digital voice recorder is, as long as it'll give you good, clear quality audio, that's what you're looking for. Now, nowadays, a cell phone with a good app, you can probably get by with that. An EMF meter is helpful. A MEL meter is really nice because it's multifunction. It gives you different things. But they're kind of expensive. So you can go on the cheap end and get a cell sensor. I think they're about $25 or so. Now, run on a 9-volt battery. It is kind of plasticky. They're pretty cheap. They're on the low end of the Gauss meter. I think they go up to the one that I use. I've got a couple of them. They go up to, they've got two sections that goes up to 1 milligauss and 5 gauss. So it's pretty low on the end, but they're nice because they light up and they make a noise. And I don't have to have it right there next to me to know if it's going off or not. I can have it on a remote camera and see if it's going off.
Oh yeah. Okay. And that's the one with they got the cover on the top end and it flashes red or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. That's the one. Okay. Another piece that I carry, I like to run experiments. And so I've got a liquid filled aircraft compass that I aim a camera at or a webcam at. And I've got a small program called Supervision Cam that'll take pictures if it denotes some type of change.
Oh, neat.
So I run that as well. You don't have to have that. You could have a sheet of paper and lay some coins down, draw a circle around it, and you could aim a camera at it even. But like, if you don't aim a camera at it, take pictures of it before when you start and then take pictures again, see if anything changed. Like, that doesn't cost anything.
Okay.
So you don't have to spend a lot of money on these things. I think I have the ability to get some more expensive equipment. So I've got a hunting trap cameras because they run batteries, and the remote, the car will hold a couple of thousand pictures. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to really do anything. You just turn them on, you let them go, see if they capture anything. The two expensive items are the full spectrum DSLR camera and the thermal camera.
Oh, okay.
And that's just an add-on. You don't have to have that, but it's nice to have those options.
Now, is that a FLIR? Do you have a FLIR or do you use another off-brand?
No, it's a FLIR.
Okay.
FLIR Scout. It's like the cheapest one of the Scout. It's like $500.
Okay. Okay, very good. And now, have you ever caught anything convincing on the thermal? I've always wondered about that.
Not yet. It's got to be, if I'd see anything, it has to be pretty close because it's short range. So it works pretty good for inside of a house. Mm-hmm. But outside, it's kind of tough because it only, at 100 yards, the resolution is so low, you really can't pick up or determine if there's anything there or not.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. No, I think those are great. And, you know, I've seen some FLIR captures that look pretty impressive, but I, you know, obviously when you're looking at, you know, any kind of evidence that's presented on YouTube, it's, you know, impossible to quantify it to any degree.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
You know, and so. Yeah.
I think that the interesting ones are mostly in UV. I don't know why. That's that one picture that I sent you that we talked about on the YouTube channel. That was the full spectrum picture with the light in the top left corner.
Right.
I don't know what that is, but it's really strange. Okay. So it seems to be that we can detect them easier in UV. And I think we were talking with on the panel that Lisa was running a UV light. She got an EVP that said it burns.
Yes.
Which is really interesting. That's I don't know exactly what that means. But, I don't run a UV light. I just run it with no light at all and see if anything comes up.
Now that it is interesting. And that, you know, that kind of made me pause and consider, is that why perhaps there's, you know, and I don't know that there's more activity at night. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, we are just more tuned in when the world is quieter, you know, so it's usually quieter at night and it's easier to focus on, you know, the subtleties that you might miss during the day. But I think paranormal events happen all the time, but, you know, we're just more cued in the dark.
I think that's right. People are home at night.
Yeah.
And people are asleep at night. And that's why you would see more people complain about paranormal things at night, because that's when they're home or in their home. And Right. The winter months usually pick up because you're in home most often. You're not out most of the time. You're usually in the house. And so that could account for some of the pickup in the wintertime.
Now, have you ever investigated during the day, and have you ever caught some great evidence that way? Or do you notice there's a difference between day and night?
Not really. I've done some during the day. We did a business during the day, and we caught some interesting EVPs. So I think this energy is everywhere, and it doesn't matter what time of the day that it can manifest. It can manifest whatever it wants to. I think that it needs people as a trigger to manifest. It's part of the process. Because we did an event where we were investigating an old playhouse, and we had a local reporter who wanted to tag along and ask questions. And he said, "Why don't you just set everything up and just go take a break?" And I said, "Because we need to be here. We're part of the trigger." I don't know why, but it seems like we have to be here in order for things to happen sometimes.
Oh, okay. And that is interesting, and it makes you wonder, is it the energy of the living that may trigger these events to some degree? And you know what I mean? Is there I don't even know what the term would be, but our biological energy being present may be, like you say, a trigger. In our absence, there's plenty of footages and stuff coming around of things that are caught on CCTVs and stuff. And again, you know, you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt, because you don't have the ability to, you know, when you look at something on YouTube, you have no ability to question the people involved. You have no ability to look at the setting, test it, try to debunk it, look at the equipment, look for, you know, possibilities for debunking activity as well. But, I think that there may be perhaps it's more residual things that just happen when they happen, but intelligent things may need the presence in order to be, you know, to be active.
Yeah, it could be. I've been taking a real close examination of this idea of intelligent versus residual. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good way to collate spiritual activity, but it doesn't seem like a high resolution answer. I don't think it's a complete enough answer. Sure. And the reason I don't think that is because we don't classify human activity like that. If you pass somebody on the street who was engrossed in a phone call and didn't pay any attention to you wouldn't label that as some type of residual event. And I don't think there's that much of a difference between us and spirits. Mm-hmm. So why do we treat them like, and this is another point that I was thinking of. It seems like we treat spirits as one-dimensional things. This mm-hmm. spirit is sad. This spirit is angry. This spirit is playful. Mm-hmm. And it seems like we treat them, well, that's just how they are all the time. I don't buy it, because mm-hmm. people aren't like that all the time. Why would spirits be like that all the time? I think that they have the ability to change themselves, given maybe the people they're around. I'm not sure yet. It's going to take a lot more research to try and figure that kind of thing out. But I don't think that spirits are static and they're stuck in this one mode of being.
That's good. I hope you're right, because I think it's tragic as hell to think that that's their existence, you know. And you hear people refer to that, well, they're stuck in their death state. Well, what kind of deal is that? You know, that you got to sit there and experience your death over and over and over and over and over. That to me just breaks my heart, to be honest. So I'm really hoping you're right, because that would be wonderful if they, you know, were as dynamic and robust emotionally as we are. Then, you know, maybe they have good days, maybe they have bad days.
I hope so. This is why I've been aiming my research a lot at psychology and philosophy, and to try and learn as much in that area and see if there's a key there that we're just not getting into. Mm-hmm. Which leads me to that people are very, very complicated. Why wouldn't spirits be?
Mm-hmm. Good point. No, I think that's brilliant. Now, do you think that it is possible that certain events can leave energy imprints, though? In other words, in terms of residual, that maybe there really isn't a spirit present, but there's an energy event that's been imprinted on the environment.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that's right, because a lot of times is we'll get residual. Somebody will say, well, that's just residual, and it's somebody walking or it's somebody doing something. It isn't always traumatic events that people will label as residual things. Mm-hmm. It's things that might repeat. So I don't think that tragic events are imprinted in the environment.
Okay.
I think that these are just the way that the spirit is reacting to what's around it. Now, as far as repeatability, humans do the same thing. Somebody that gets up at 5 o'clock, gets in the shower, goes to work at 6:30, comes home at 3, Monday through Friday, that's not a residual event. But if a spirit did that, you would label it as that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think that we have to take a closer examination of that.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because we do love our rituals. I mean, I have my morning rituals as well. I get up, I brush my teeth first thing in the morning, use the restroom, and the next thing I do is make my coffee. That's like every morning. That's how it works. And so,
right. So if you had a spirit that went up to the bathroom and came down to the kitchen, when you right, that would be labeled as a residual. Yeah. Oh, that's a residual. That's something caught in the atmosphere. Sure. I don't think that's correct. I think that's just how that particular spirit likes to manifest itself, because that's what it's used to.
Sure. No, that's a cool point. And there, you might be right. I don't know. I'm not sure what to think of that, but I guess I can see it both ways, but I like that you're questioning it, and I think that, that's the way we learn, is by questioning. So good on you, and I hope that you're able to, come to some conclusions on that, because that's wonderful. It's, that's what I love about this, is that there are researchers like yourself that are really trying to expand the envelope. They're trying to expand the knowledge base, and the only way you can do that is by challenging the status quo and either substantiating or putting holes in it.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's something that, because of the nature of what we're studying, we don't know a lot about of it. We've got to really try and get down to the base level of these things that we're just utilizing just because we're utilizing, because everybody else does. And I think we really got to pry at them and get underneath them and see what's really going on, and we're just not going to get anywhere.
Right. No, I think that's true. Very true. So now in the case of an investigation, walk us through your process, and including some techniques that you usually rely on during your investigations, so that our listeners understand the real world investigating.
Usually, so a client will call up or leave an email, and we'll get a hold of them on the phone, talk to them, see what's going on, and then we'll do what's called a walkthrough, which is a preliminary. And you're just going there with a minimal equipment, right? Pen and paper, flashlight, voice recorder, maybe an EMF detector, something like that. And you're just sit down, listen to them, write down what they're saying, walk around the place and see if an investigation is warranted, or maybe it's something that can be resolved with education. Education seems to be a lot of what we do here. I'll give you an example. One of the most common things that we hear about, or at least one of the most common complaints, is, I feel like I'm being watched. I'm doing the dishes, I feel like I'm being watched. I'm doing the laundry, or I'm laying down in bed, I feel like I'm being watched. Now, I've been really trying to examine that statement, because what does that mean? I feel like I'm being watched. Everybody says it. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means that we can see with our bodies. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. Human beings are very adept at knowing when a pair of phobias are being aimed at you. Mm-hmm. So one of the side effects are usually if somebody says they're laying down in bed and they feel like they're being watched, the first culprit I go to is a clock radio, because clock radios are notorious for spraying out EMF radiation like a fire hose. Oh. Where does everybody keep their clock radio? Right by their head.
Right.
So if it could be an EMF sensitivity thing. So the first thing we'll try is, you got a clock radio there, put that somewhere else in the room. Mm-hmm. Let's try that, see if it's something different. Or if they're doing laundry or something in a particular spot, get the EMF meter or the millimeter out, see if there's a hot spot somewhere that's nearby, see if there's something unshielded or a transformer that's nearby that could be affecting it. Mm-hmm. That's one possible explanation. And then if an investigation is warranted, we'll come by and we'll tell the client, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take note of everything that they're complaining about, things that they've seen or heard. We set up our equipment, and then the first thing right out of the gate, debunking if we can. If they're seeing doors open and close or they're hearing things, we'll try and simulate something so we can try and see, you know, is there a vacuum effect if we open this door here and that door pops open? Is it a light switch that goes on and off when we pull the faceplate, a light is all burned out or something? What was another one we had? We had a client that said they heard scratching in the wall, and we found a 2-foot hole opening in their soffit. And so, well, there's an animal getting up there. That's not paranormal. That's you got to call a pest agent. Mm-hmm. So then it's a lot of, after we do that, it's kind of an introduction to the space. Mm-hmm. We kind of have a meeting, come together, we'll talk about what we're going to do, and then kind of introduce ourselves to the space. So that's really as simple as, hi, my name is Mike. This is my friend Brent. This is what we're here to do. We know the people that live here. They say that they're seeing things or hearing things. We're here to check that out, and we're here just to listen to anything that you might have to say. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, it's so like, you have an introduction and you have a closing at the end of us, you know, hey, thanks for letting us be in your space with you. If you said anything, you know, hopefully we heard it. Thank you for letting us be here. Mm-hmm. And then we go back and everybody goes through all of their evidence. What am I forgetting? Pictures. One of the things we do at the beginning is we get background things taken care of. So we get the temperature of the entire place inside and out, any EMF spikes that might be there inside and out. And then we take pictures of everything on the inside of the building, on the outside of the building, around the structure. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily to collect anything paranormal, but I want to know if something moves, where did it start from? What is it originating? We also look at anything that's out in the open. Is there medication that's out on the open? Is there anything that might denote occultism, like books or pictures or things of that matter? Mm-hmm. They might have something that plays an effect in it. So we all take note of those things. And I think that's how we go about doing our investigations.
Oh, that's really cool. And as far as techniques, do you prefer people to be alone in specific locations, or do you think in teams of two, or do you think it just depends on the situation?
It does depend on the situation, but generally having people alone next to where we have audio set up in different areas of the house. And so the first thing will be go hang up, sit down in the room where your audio is and just, you know, bring your pen and paper, bring your flashlight, sit and listen. Anything happens, write it down. And then we break it up into hour segments. And then at the end of the hour, bring everybody back and we'll talk about, you know, did anything happen? Do you have anything to report of?
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Now, have you found that there's you often hear things like personal experiences, but not captured. Do you find that in these investigations, a lot of activities are mostly personal experiences, and they're not substantiated by either readings or weren't able to be captured on film or whatever. Because, you know, even as an investigator, all you can do is just try to blanket things as well as you can, but there's no telling when or where something is going to happen, you know? But how do you quantify personal experiences in terms of the investigation?
Personal experiences are something that you write down and put in the log. Mm-hmm. If it correlates to another piece of evidence, then that makes it rather interesting. But stand alone by themselves, I don't know if they're entirely pertinent unless it's something that the client has been talking about.
Oh, okay.
If something that the client talked about and then that happens to one of our investigators, maybe in the area that the client has been talking about, mm-hmm. now that's some kind of corroboration. Okay, we've experienced that and we can look into that a little deeper.
Now, do you recommend I suppose most of the time, especially when you're doing homes and stuff, you can probably only investigate, in one night windows. But would you advocate longer term, if possible, investigating?
Yes. Yeah. We've had clients that have had us come back on multiple occasions. Mm-hmm. And the longer time that you're there, the more that you can pick up, the more answers you're going to have.
Sure.
And so usually it's a one time will be 4 to 6 hours, depending on activity. Mm-hmm. But if we can come back and we can come back, like there was one lady that had us back, I think 2 or 3 times. And one of the interesting that happened is there was a lot of shadow activity at that place. And it looked like on one wall, it looked like it was a shadow puppet show.
Jeez.
Where you just had these shadows interacting with each other and dancing around. It was like, okay, that's all right. That's pretty strange. Cool.
Wow. That is really cool. How did that turn out, by the way?
it was interesting. It was what she was experiencing.
Okay.
We picked up one of the spirits called me Pudgy Man, which was pretty funny. So we have an EVP that said, Pudgy Man. It's like, that's funny, bro. Funny. He's got jokes. All right.
Well, at least you're leaving an impression. Oh, man, that's awesome. Well, I tell you what, brother. I mean, I know we could talk and talk and talk and never get to the end of this, but we are at about our hour. So I just want to thank you so much for taking the time and spending some time with us here and helping us understand the world of the investigator a little bit better.
Oh, no problem, buddy. Anytime.
Well, I'm going to take you up on that for sure. You'll have to come back and we'll have to, you know, this is kind of a good preliminary episode to discuss paranormal investigating, but I think you'll need to come back and do more episodes, more dialed into specific content. But thank you so much, man. It's been a real pleasure. Obviously you and I go way back, so it's always great when we can talk, but I have to tell you that, you know, even though I've talked to you many, many times over the years, I still, you know, I'm always thrilled to hear from you and to hear what you've got to say.
Well, thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. I'm just some guy out here trying to figure things out. So hopefully we can, we can try and figure something out.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much. And everybody, thank you so much for tuning in and checking out the show. Again, make sure you're subscribed. Oh, by the way, Mike, how can people stay in touch with you if they want to follow up with what you're up to or anything in terms of your investigations?
I've got a YouTube channel, MCAT/CAT. I'm on the Paranormal Portal most of the time in the chat room, so you can talk to me there. I'm working on restructuring the channel to more of a paranormal thing. It's just kind of been something I'm kicking around with and doing little crazy things on, but I'm working on a restructuring and kind of, you know, maybe doing some hour-long discussion videos and doing some, you know, philosophy of use videos or something like that. I'm not sure yet. Also on Facebook, Mike Hetzel, HETZEL. You can look me up on there. And if you got a question, you can just ask me and I'll talk to you. I don't care.
Perfect. Well, thanks again, brother. And thank you all. Be good, be kind, be nice. Take care of each other. Help each other out. find the magic in every day and remember to laugh as much as you can. Take care, everybody, and stay tuned for another podcast, which will be dropping 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And a special thanks to Revolver Podcast for making this all possible. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Hi, this is Don with Paranormal Portal. Thank you for checking out our Paranormal Portal podcast. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/paranormalportal. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/paranormalportalradio.
Betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.